Welcome to the No Film School podcast. This is Gigi Hawkins, and this week I speak with Juan Carlos Fresnadillo, the director of the new film Damsel, which is now out on Netflix, starring Millie Bobby Brown, Nick Robinson, Robin Wright, Angela Bassett, Ray Winston. I mean, this is a stacked cast and a dragon that is, I think, putting the rest of the dragons that we see in film and TV to the fire right now. I sat down with Juan Carlos last week in one of the press junket virtual interviews where he was actually sitting in what it looked like the caves of the movie. And it was so fun to talk with him. The film is a dark fantasy that upends the trope of the damsel in distress. And I am so pumped for this conversation because not only do we get into Juan Carlos's inspiration for becoming a filmmaker and why he was drawn to the film, but also the tactical elements of how he approaches filmmaking, from what he's literally carrying with him every time he's on set to how he came up with the concept for this fire in the film. The film itself is about the dark descent into adulthood, and it's claustrophobic and intense and beautiful. And it's so fun to see Millie Bobby Brown growing into this powerful role and this powerful performer. It's also a conversation that left me feeling equipped to be holding a film this big in my head as a director, and gave me tactical advice for managing a story with scale and a scope that is quite extensive. And now my interview with Juan Carlos Fresnadillo.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Nice to meet you, Juan Carlos.
Very nice to meet you, Gigi. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited to talk to you about the film. And I see that you're still in the caves.
I am still in the caves. I'm trapped. The dragon doesn't allow me to go out. So, it is what it is.
There had to be compromise. There had to be some kind of compromise.
I have to make a deal with her to see if I could have some time.
Exactly. Well, we are an outlet. We speak to a lot of emerging filmmakers. We reach people as they're starting out their careers as directors, including myself. You know, 6 years ago, I discovered the No Film School podcast when I was like, how the hell do I make a movie?
Fantastic.
So I'd love to hear how you got your start as a filmmaker.
It's funny, you know, I got the impression that my mother was a big reason for making movies. And because when I was a kid, I remember her passion telling me about the movies that she loved and talking to me about the actresses that she loved. She was a big fan of Gone with the Wind and Splendor on the Grass. And she was full of passion and excitement when she told me about those stories and the life of the actors. So literally, in some ways, she infected me with the passion for, you know, movies and telling stories. Definitely, she was the first step into this thing. I would say that the second step is also related with my family, and it was the fact that my father used to shoot every single family encounter with a Super 8 camera. And, you know, seeing your father all the time with that thing, shooting everybody, it was like, oh, this is, what is this? You know, and the way that he was directing the people to move around, it was kind of a interesting thing to me. And also the magical thing was that after 2 weeks after he did that, he received in an envelope the film, and he displayed the screen in the living room and the projector and all the lights off, and everybody was
incredible, there looking
at the screen. So it was like a magical moment seeing the screen, our family turning into those kind of almost like big actors in the movie, you know?
Yeah.
So definitely that was really important, I would say, you know, because, and it's funny because also, if you think about all the movies that I made, there is always a family drama in every single movie.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, the family as a dramatic scenario, as an emotional landscape, it's probably the thing that I feel most connected with. And I think it's related with that, you know, with the idea that my family was on the screen, on the big screen, since I was a kid. And the third layer to turn myself into a filmmaker, definitely, when I was an adolescent, I watched all the movies from Mr. Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, I remember that I saw Notorious, and it was like a crush, you know? I thought, oh my God, I have to make movies like this. In fact, I've never done a romantic thriller, and I am crazy for making a romantic thriller. I really hope to make it soon, you know, because in some ways it's like a pending thing that I have to do, you know, in order to honor my origins, you know? So yeah, those are I would say the three layers that shaped the idea of me as a filmmaker, you know, my mother, my father, and Mr. Alfred Hitchcock.
And Mr. Hitchcock.
Yeah.
And we respect them all equally and raising,
exactly.
Raising us. I love that you identified family as a through line of the stories you tell in your career.
Yeah.
I mean, you've told stories about family during a zombie apocalypse. You've told stories of a family and complicated family dynamics, which I think Damsel explores in a fascinating way, that's turning, you know, this traditional fairy tale trope on its head. I personally grew up, I was actually talking to my dad yesterday because it's my birthday, and he was calling to say, happy birthday, you're a young woman, and you were such a princess. You were such a, like, identified so much with the very traditional princess, the princess that was waiting to be saved. And I'm a little bit sad that I didn't get to watch this movie as a kid, because I was like, oh, this is the narrative. But I think it works so well because it's so rooted in family dynamics, which is just this universal theme.
Absolutely.
So I'd love to hear about that. Like, how did you, especially, you know, taking the script that you came to, how did you sort of unpack the family baggage, if you will, that ultimately led to this story?
I think, you know, since I read the script from the beginning, I immediately saw that this is like a family movie. And if you think in the big picture, this is not only about the family of Elodie. It's also about the family, the royal family, and the dragon family as well. So it's three families intertwining with each other and creating this kind of melting pot of complicated relationships, of some sort of betrayal, loyalty, you know, all those big themes around them, you know? And whatever happens in the story finally shapes almost like a new order in these families. Some of them die in the process, and the other ones are kind of creating a new idea about family, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I love that in Damsel. You know? I think this movie is about that, about transformation. And the transformation from Elodie also affects all the layers in the story. All the characters in the story are also transformed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I really love the idea that in order to create like a new order in this kind of universe of Damsel, you have to start first with your protagonist and witnessing how she literally transformed herself from a young woman, beautiful, willing to help her father, into this fighter, new princess who is sweating, yelling, and fighting for her life. You know, to me, that's the new princess in our world. That's a contemporary princess in all the senses, you know? And that's why I was willing to shoot this movie and make it, because I think it tells a story, a traditional story, a classic story, but now with some sort of sync with our time, you know, which I think speaks loudly to the new generations. You know?
There's something very interesting about this, like classic story structure, these classic character tropes, but in this film in particular, they all exist in this gray area. And you mentioned that it's these three families melting together. And then we go on this journey with Elodie and we see her transformation and essentially her sort of descent into adulthood, maybe. And it's
I love that. Can I take that from you?
Please.
Descent into the adulthood. Love it. It's a beautiful poetic way to say that, you know, is a descent, you know. But it's a rising descent, you know, because you turn
exactly
into a beautiful new thing, you know? So yeah, that's great.
And what I love about specifically it being a story that is focused on a protagonist and the change. And if we just looked at the screen time that we have, we are mostly with Elodie on her journey alone. And like that is so much to carry from a performance perspective, from an actor perspective. But I think that gray area that we're exploring and the sort of being with her on her journey lets us explore these characters in their complexities, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like two things can be true at once. Somebody can love someone and they can make a mistake, which is fascinating. So I'd love to hear how you worked with the actors and how you explored this duality that can exist, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. You know, and I think that's related with my passion for classic dramas, you know? And if you think about that, you know, real characters are coming from a gray area. And it's funny because, you know, in this kind of, you know, traditional fantasy movies, there is a tendency to be a little bit black and white in order to create more clarity in terms of the characters. But I'm much more willing to show the gray zone, you know, because I think that takes you into the reality. Because at the end of the day, if you want to succeed with fantasy, if you want to make a fantasy movie like a real transformative experience, you have to create real characters on it.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, reality implies gray colors between the black and the white, you know? And that's why this story, every single character in this story has those gray areas, you know? Sometimes you don't know if they are good or bad. I mean, let's talk, for example, about the father. He is a likable guy. He's a likable guy. He's doing this because he really wants to help his people. And he's put in some sort of a spotlight that it's kind of very difficult to choose. Obviously, what he did is horrible. It's horrific. But at the same time, you kind of understand why he did it. And the way that he tries to redeem himself also gives you another chance for him, despite the fact that he did something horrible. So I love that. I love that kind of duality in characters, that they are evil, but at the same time, they are humans. The queen, for example, she's protecting her family. She's protecting her people. She's afraid of the dragon. So that's why she keeps this horrific tradition of killing women in that way. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you understand her reasons to do that, you know? So I really believe on those things. I think those are the nuances that takes you into a real story. And despite of the fact that you're dealing with fantasy, with visual effects, with some sort of kind of intense journey in terms of all these beautiful visuals, you have to deliver, you have to convey real characters. And the way to make it is make them real, make them humans, make them almost like people that you know. You know?
Yeah. And it lets us explore like the irony of, you know, what do you do to protect your family? To what extent will you do that? And I think I always love a story where you can have sort of this spectrum of what you're exploring, where one character is like
sacrifice anything at the sake of my family. And then one person is representing almost the extreme opposite. And that allows you to explore the gray areas and where people sit on that spectrum. One of the things that I think is fascinating with like a survival story like this is the fact that we are mostly spending time with Elodie, aka Millie Bobby Brown, our hero. And I don't know whether you shot in order, I'm assuming not, but what was your shorthand with Millie for telling her where she's at on that journey, this journey of growth? And how did you make sure that you were directing in a way that was tracking, you know, no matter when you were shooting along that bigger picture story that you were telling?
As you can imagine, you know, the complexity of this production doesn't allow you to shoot it in order, mm-hmm. which would be the dream, you know?
Yeah.
So in this particular case, we started with the caves and then we shot the beginning. And then if I remember well, yeah, we started in the caves. We shot at the end of the caves, the kind of first ending. And then we shot the beginning and the ending in the last part of the shooting. So a mess, a complete mess. So that's why it's really important when you do the preparation of this to establish almost like a Bible that you have to have with you all the time to remind you every time that you shoot a scene, where you're coming from and what is the goal of the scene and where are you heading to? Because otherwise you're lost. You're completely lost. So you need to write that Bible in some sort of bullet points, you know, to keep the energy and the continuity of the acting. And then from there, you can improvise with your actors about, you know, moving around these guidelines, you know, because also at the same time, as much as I love preparation, as much as I love doing storyboards and having, you know, very precise visual concepts, you have to give space to happy accidents. Because, you know, when you're in the set and you see all the elements placed, you have a lot of ideas, a lot. And it's a pity not to take advantage of that. And that's why, and it's funny, because if you prepare so well the movie, then you have the quietness and the calmness to say, oh, let's take advantage of this and that. And you put all these things together and create an amazing cocktail. But in order to have that beautiful cocktail, you have to have the basic ingredients really well thought and really well designed.
Yeah.
So this Bible is essential, you know? And because, you know, it's easy to lose yourself in the process. You and your collaborators, you know? Especially the actors, because the actors, they have to feel what they do. And and they have to understand that sometimes it's weird to shoot that you're starting a movie, you're starting a shooting, and suddenly you're screaming and yelling and delivering things that you haven't shot yet. So that's why it's important that the director always keeping that kind of clarity about where are you, in what part of the movie you are right now, and what you have to convey. And then from there, enough freedom to place all the things, you know, and play around, which I think it's part of the process.
I have two follow-up questions. One is, what does your Bible physically look like? Like, what are you bringing to set? We've talked to directors who are print paper in a binder. We've also had people who are completely digital on their phones. And then my second question is, what was a happy accident that you discovered since you laid that foundation that allowed you to create the cocktail of discovering on set?
My Bible is a Moleskine, you know, the black books, white page, completely white. And I usually use a pen with a very black tint in order to make it really graphic, all the writing that I do. That's my Bible. That's kind of, and I need to write it with my hand, you know, because it's the only way to, I don't know, maybe because
ingest it.
Yeah, because I was raised in some sort of analogic culture, and that's why we used hands at that time a lot. So So that's my Bible for sure.
Is it like one page per scene or
one page per scene, I would say, but maybe sometimes it's even one, two, because I do little graphics and some sort of draws, you know, but one, 2 pages for a scene, that's fair enough. Also, I like to have the script with some annotations as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm using two things, the Moleskine with my notes, but also the script with a lot of annotations and ideas and thoughts, you know, because when you see those ideas attached to the script, they make them, I mean, it looks more real to me, you know. I don't know why, because it's almost like it feels that you're introducing those ideas in the movie in a natural way if you see
absolutely
with the script. And in terms of the happy accidents, it's always, I mean, to me, the happy accidents comes from the fact that you're with the camera, you're trying to block the scene and you put the camera. And then suddenly I'm gonna tell you an example that it happened to me. There's one shot, I don't know if you remember the shot, when she falls into the cave and she's yelling and asking for help, we see how suddenly you see the dragon eye open.
Yeah.
And then the next shot after that one, it's kind of almost, it looks like a point of view of the dragon, but it's not a point of view of the dragon, but it's kind of a top angle shot. And the movie is, the camera is spinning, you know, it's like, and Elodie is looking almost to the camera in some sort of desperate way. And she's kind of kneeling down and crying, sobbing and desperately because she's, you know, nobody's coming, you know? So that position of the camera and that spinning was a complete accident. And it's one of my favorite shots in the movie because I think it tells you so well how her world is literally spinning around and it's changing the whole thing. The camera tells you an emotion that is happening inside of her. And it was an accident. The camera, the camera operator with the crane, he was adjusting the camera and I saw how he was spinning the camera and I said, hey, hold on, that's amazing, let's do that. But it wasn't thought before, you know? So that's why, again, you have to be open to these things. Yeah. But I got the feeling that that idea, that accident came, or at least I grabbed that accident because I already thought about, okay, when she falls into the caves, the whole world is going to be spinning around and she's going to be upside down. Conceptually speaking. So then you grab that idea because you're completely prepared everything before, you know?
Absolutely. You know the intention of the moment.
Yeah.
And I got chills with when you said that because like, you know, that a bit, just the clicking of a moment. And I think as the director, you need to be able to be receptive and open and identify when something like that happens and is working. And it's very easy, especially as an emerging filmmaker, to think that we just have to stick to the plan and it will be okay.
No.
Which is not true. Exactly. Not true.
But you have to have the plan.
Oh,
you have to have
it. You got to have the plan. Exactly.
You have to have the plan. Even
the
for
plan.
Making it like this and throwing into the garbage. But you have to have the plan. That's the only way that you're going to be quiet, calm, to receive new ideas. Otherwise, you're going to be so stressed. I never understood directors that they go to the set and they never thought about the camera. And they say, no, let's think tomorrow and let's figure it out there. Mistake. You're not going to figure out anything. You're gonna be kind of chasing a fire or trying to, you know, to create something that you don't have the time to properly think, you know? So that's why the plan is so important.
And you're doing justice to the story. You mentioned fire. So I'm gonna use that to pivot into my question about the fire of this movie.
Yeah.
I have seen a lot of fire. I've seen a lot of dragon fire in my day. This is my favorite fire in a movie. It is violent and vicious and something about it felt so specific to this world and alive. So I'd love to talk about how the fire came to be and what that process was and how you designed the look of the fire.
It's so funny that you ask this because, you know, it's one of the things that I'm really proud of in this movie, you know, and it took a lot of time to properly have that beautiful simulation of fire because as you can imagine, it's full CGI. We didn't use any fire. And I have to thank to my visual effects supervisor, Nigel, that he was so picky in the process of creating this fire. But I have to tell you that we had a pitch from the very beginning in the process of this, which was kind of unique. And I've been kind of digging why we decided to do it in that way. And I found the reason, you know. To me, the fire of this dragon has to be so real. And real in the sense that it's a fire that it's not coming from gas. It's coming from liquid. It's almost like oil coming from her mouth. So it literally, you feel the organic creation of this fire with this idea that it's almost like liquid, you know, like that flies in flames, you know. And probably I really love this idea because, you know, I was born in an island, in a volcanic island, Tenerife. And since I was a kid, I've been living in a place that any day could burn and any day we could have an eruption of this volcano. And if you think about lava, the way that it moves, the way that it's like that, it's fire and water at the same time. The lava moves like liquid, but it's pure fire. And probably that's kind of obsession that I have since I was a kid. And coincidentally, months before the shooting, there was an eruption in Canary Islands. Oh. I was born, and I went to see the volcano. And I was so close to the volcano, and I was seeing all that fire, lava coming out of the volcano. And it was completely printed in my mind. And funny enough, now we have this fire which is kind of volcanic fire, you know?
Yeah.
So to me, it makes sense, the connection, in many ways. And now, and I'm so happy that you noticed that, because it's true. It's really fantastic, the fire in the movie.
It's visceral, and it feels like it mirrors the story, like the character.
Yeah.
Like it's this fire in her belly, and it is angry and violent. And yeah, like these are the things that I think separate good from great is making choices that are intentional beyond intention. So everything is connecting as part of this world and part of the story. One element that I thought was fascinating was, you know, the fact that you built out these caves on stages in London. And I'd love to hear about, like, when you were in that process, a specific moment where you saw something that wasn't working and how you identified that and how you redirected into sort of figuring out what did make sense for the film. And you'd know this because you're sitting in the caves right now. It's perfect.
So, I mean, building the caves was a big challenge because we wanted to build something real, but at the same time, practical to shoot it in a way. So always it was a conflict, you know, and Patrick Tatopoulos, the production designer, did such an amazing job. I think he is the full responsible of the level of realism that these caves have. But at the same time, we were kind of sometimes arguing about the space because you have to create moving walls. You have to make it bigger to put better, to have better camera positions. But doing that, you ruin the realism. So it is like a dance and sometimes not pleasant dance to have the proper space to shoot and also the realistic place to make it feel real. So yeah, it was tricky. It was really difficult. And also think that we started the shooting with that for almost 2 months in a row.
Wow.
And that's a long time to spend in such a kind of claustrophobic spaces with no much light around and literally shooting somebody running, jumping, screaming, and suffering. So it's a long time. It's a psychological battle for sure.
Yeah. Would you do anything with the crew? Like if things were feeling really dark and heavy, did you have a go-to thing where you're like, okay, we're going to shake it off, everyone? Or like, candy bars for everyone to, you know, to keep it safe and light on set?
Yes, we try as much as we can, but to be honest, British people are so serious and so professional, yes, and so straight to the point. So sometimes it was difficult to shake the whole thing off and make it fun. But yeah, we had some days that it was really fun and pleasant to shoot, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Well, as we wrap up here, let's speak to our emerging filmmaker audience, the folks who are just getting their start. What advice do you have for somebody who is on their first step to make their first short, or is just interested in entering this space?
I would say that, you know, it's difficult to give advices, you know, but I remember when I was so young to something that it's completely unforgettable from one of my teachers who said, you have to follow, you have to chase your own voice. Mm-hmm. And no matter if you're surrounded by really smart people, no matter if sometimes you doubt about yourself, you have to put that aside and follow your instinct and follow your voice, you know, because at the end of the day it's about that. It's about a voice. It's about a vision. It's not about you. So, which is tricky. Sometimes we confuse your voice with you. No, your voice is related with the story, with a vision about something. And that is sometimes it's completely away from you, but you have to respect that and you have to honor that. And you have to put everybody working in that direction. And that is kind of the most important thing to do when you're making a movie.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I love this conversation.
Me
too.
Could
talk to you for many more hours. Congrats on the film.
Thank you.
I can't wait for the world to see it. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
All right.
Thank you so much, Juan Carlos, for joining us and for digging into the juicy gray areas of storytelling and character development. It's so fun to be able to unpack that with filmmakers, and specifically in this story where we're exploring and upending these tropes that we all have sort of built into our story DNA. It's such a great lesson in the stories that we tell and the stories that we're drawn to. Check out this film for a cocktail of adventure, darkness, practical effects, and really powerful VFX used in a way that push the story and push the tension. Let us know what you thought of our conversation. And thank you so much to our listeners for tuning in. You can get more No Film School at nofilmschool.com. You can also like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast across all platforms for podcasting. And you can follow us on social media at No Film School. Thank you again for tuning in.